belt in case he might have to cut Fancy out of her harness. They started a quarter mile from the crossing at a fast trot, and then hit the water at a gallop. Johanna clung to the long seats, and waves of spray battered the Curative Waters Sulphur Springs, Texas gold letters. They slowed as the current stopped them, and then it took hold of the little mare and their wagon as well. Crows shot up out of the far bank, screaming. Foam churned around them. Drift and duff ran on top of the fast water in snaking lines. Briefly, the wagon floated. The roan mare snorted, went under, came up, and beat at the floodwaters with her hooves. Then she struck hard bottom, and they pulled up on the far bank with water draining in streams. Pasha was a constitutionally brave horse, and he plunged in after them without hesitation, and struck out and came out a few yards downstream with triumphant little tosses of his head. He shook himself in a flying halo of spray, and came trotting to join them and was retied to the wagon. As they went on, the captain cocked his head and listened to a steady clicking sound. He got down and looked at the front wheel. There was a break in the iron tire. Nothing to do about it now. Maybe there would be a blacksmith in Spanish Fort. That night, the captain demonstrated to her the little sheet-iron stove he had bought along with the wagon. It would make less smoke than a campfire. It was the size of a large ammunition box with a small chimney going up 2 feet or so, enough to keep smoke out of their faces. He let down the tailgate and patted the stove where it sat, square and black and forbidding. She had no idea what it was for. "Stove," he said. "Fire." He fitted the pipes. She stood in front of it in her yellow and blue striped dress, her bare feet, the bright taffy-colored hair streaming down her back, damp with the drizzle. In a swift motion, she suddenly carried her right arm down in front of herself and then snapped her fingers upward in a blossom of hard nails and calluses. "Ah," said the captain. "Sign. The sign for fire." He knew a bit of the Plains Indian sign language, and so he made the sign for yes. This was encouraging. They at least had some limited means of speech. He showed her how the stove worked. The top lid, the size of a hand, the draft wheel. He strung up one of the wagon's side curtains between a short warped post oak and the wagon's side to make a shelter against the drizzle. She watched his every move. Perhaps she was afraid. Perhaps she knew she had to learn how these things worked. The horses were happy with their morales, feed bags holding a hefty portion of shelled corn. The girl stood beside the little mare and ran her hand down the horse's leg. She made a little pitying noise. The mare was young and strong, but she had a slightly twisted right foreleg. The hoof turned inward several degrees, and because of this the captain had got her cheap. The girl had spotted it immediately, and she patted the mare gently as she and Pasha stood side by side and ground up their corn with a noise like hand grinders. The captain found dry sticks in the clusters of tall bear grass and fished his match safe out of his inner coat pocket. He did everything slowly and deliberately. He started the fire. Johanna watched with a cautious expression, a mistrustful look. She bent toward the little stove to peer in the grate and saw the air sucked into it to make the sticks burn with more intensity. Cautiously, she patted the top and then snatched her hand back.
"Pete so hot."
"Yes," he said, "whatever that means. Hot, I suppose." He made up coffee and a corn dodger and fried bacon. She sat under the canvas side curtain with her food in her hands for a long time. At last she sang over it, as if adoring it, as if the bacon were a live being and the smoking dodger a gift from the corn woman. There was no campfire to throw shadows, but there was a half moon waxing, and it seemed to run in reverse between cascading clouds that flowed together and then pulled apart and then ran together again. The captain wiped his plate with the cornbread. She might run. She had nowhere to go, however. The Kiowa were across the river, and the river was a loose and moving ocean of foaming, rusty flood water nearly half a mile wide that carried off entire trees. She might lay hands on the revolver or the shotgun, and he could wake up in the next world. The captain lay back on his old Spanish saddle that he had turned upside down, his head pillowed on the fleecing. He brought out the Chicago Tribune and flipped through it by the light of the candle in the candle lantern. She lay rolled in a thick serape called a jorongo in a red and black diamond pattern and stared at him with her open, flat blue eyes. He rattled the pages and said, "There's a big new packing plant in Chicago. Astounding, isn't it? They feed the cattle in at one end, and at the other end they come out in cans." She never took her eyes from him. He knew she was prepared for some kind of violence. Captain Kidd was a man old not only in years, but in wars. He smiled at her at last and took out his pipe, more than ever knowing in his fragile bones that it was the duty of men who aspired to the condition of humanity to protect children and kill for them if necessary. It comes to a person most clearly when he has daughters. He had thought he was done raising daughters. As for protecting this feral child, he was all for it in principle, but wished he could find somebody else to do it. "You are an immense amount of trouble," he said. "We will both be happy when you are with your relatives and you can make their lives a living hell." Her face did not change. She wiped her nose slowly on her sleeve. He turned the page. He said, "This is writing. This is printing. This tells us of all the things we ought to know in the world, and also that we ought to want to know." He glanced over at her. He said, "There are places in the world called England and Europe and India." He blew smoke from his nose. He probably should not be smoking. You could smell it for miles. "India," she whispered. She began to place her fingertips together one by one. He lay back in his blankets and said his prayers for Britt, who was always in harm's way in his travels, for the safety of his daughters and son-in-law and the grandsons, perhaps soon to travel at his request the long and perilous journey from Georgia. This would include crossing the Mississippi. For his own safety and that of Johanna, also in harm's way. So many people, so much harm. He put his hat over his face, and after a while, he fell asleep. 5. The next day they went on toward Spanish Fort. The road wound along the south edge of the river in the great valley of the Red. More than a mile away south was the rise of land and the bluffs. At some distant time the river had been there, tearing away land. Over the centuries it moved like a big red snake from one side of its valley to the other. The rain had stopped for now. The captain was unhappy about her walking, but she would not ride, nor would she put on her shoes. She watched the river. She well knew that on the other side was Indian territory. Her mother was over there, her father, perhaps brothers and sisters, and all her kin group, her clan within the tribe, perhaps a young man to whom she might have been promised. The black trunks of the live oak were twisted and wiry as chimney brushes. A good place for an ambush. He wished he had a dog. He should have got a dog from somebody. She stopped and held up her hand. She was looking ahead. He twitched the long reins and fancy stopped. Behind them, Pasha pointed his ears ahead and suddenly called out in a long, ringing cry. Captain Kidd pulled out the revolver and once again checked his loads. All dry. He laid it beside him on the floorboards next to the wagon seat on the left side and covered it with a canvas-wrapped flitch of bacon. He reminded himself that the 38 cartridges were hidden in the flour keg. After a few moments he heard the sound of about 10 horses and the jingling of bits and saddle gear. Their shod hooves clicked on the stones of the road. A company of U.S. Army mounted infantry rode into view a quarter of a mile down the road. He jumped down and grabbed the girl by the upper arm. He made the sign for good in front of her face. They were on one of the few straight and level stretches between all the thick post oak, and the soldiers came toward him and Johanna in a unit of blue and of flashing, well-shined leather, appearing out of the trees like ghost soldiers. He turned her to him and made the sign for friend. She had turned the color of pastry. Her lips were trembling. He led her to the wagon wheel and lifted her so that she put one bare foot on a spoke, and then sprang up into the wagon bed and sank down in a welter of skirts and loose hair. She pulled the thick wool harango over her head. He came up after her, sat down on the driver's seat, unwrapped the reins from the driver's post. "It's all right, Johanna."
"Johanna?"
He knew she thought he was going to hand her over to the army, that this was probably an arranged meeting. The man in front was a lieutenant. His shoulder insignia with the double bars winked in the dim light. Therefore, it was a regular patrol trotting up and down the road on the south side of the Red, looking for signs of raiders crossing over, although with the flooding it was unlikely. They all carried the square-backed Navy Colt five-shot revolvers that looked as big as pork hams in their holsters, and the 56-caliber Colt carbines, also standard issue for the wild country. The lieutenant called for the column to halt and then rode alongside and said, "Good day." The 10 men behind him kicked their feet out of the stirrups to relieve their knees, and some took the opportunity to drink from canteens. At the rear, their pack mules brayed at his horses in long, demented shrieks like train whistles. "Good day," said the captain. The lieutenant looked over the wagon and saw the girl on the floor of the wagon bed just behind the captain, her expression of stiffened fright or even terror. She was as close to the captain's revolver as she could get. She slid out her hand and grasped the butt where it lay hidden under the flitch of bacon, her hand and arm covered in the red wool serape. "The young lady seems very disturbed," said the lieutenant. There was surprise in his voice, suspicion. "She was a captive," said the captain. "I'm returning her to her people in Castroville, Bexar County." He handed over the agent's papers. "I'd like to have a look at her," said the lieutenant. He read through the papers. The agent's handwriting was very good, very clear. He read it easily, the girl's description, her approximate height and complexion. Then he raised his head. His shoulder bars winked with drops. The river made an endless thunder to their left. They could see it through the trees. "Yes, I'll try," said the captain. He settled his hat more firmly on his head and stepped over the back of the wagon seat and grasped the thick red wool and pulled it from her head. "Johanna," he said. "Johanna." He patted her shoulder. "Well, damn," said the lieutenant. He was taken aback by the flat, wild look on the girl's face. "You'd think she would be happy to be going home." The captain stood between Johanna and the lieutenant. He said, "They took her at age 6. As far as she knows, she's a Kiowa." "I see. Well, I hope you'll apprise her of the facts." He leaned to one side to see around the captain and stared at her appraisingly, and then bent from his saddle to hand the papers back to the captain. He said, "You're the man who reads the news."
"Yes, I am."
"I was there at Fort Belknap when you read."
"Glad to hear it."
"I don't suppose you have your loyalty oath papers to show me?"
"No, I don't."
"Since you are on a sort of official business, you will need them. If you voluntarily aided the Confederate Army in any way, you will need a certified copy of your loyalty oath."
"I did not."
"Were your boys in the conflict?"
"I don't have any."
"Are you armed?"
"All I have is a 20-gauge shotgun."
"Let me see it." Captain Kidd drew out the old shotgun and worked the bolt and caught the shell as it flew out.
"Birdshot."
He stood in the wagon bed and handed it over. Johanna had in some way fed her thin body almost completely under the wagon seat, and again drew up the thick red wool Mexican blanket over her head. She drew the revolver close to her and stared at the wagon floorboards and listened to every nuance, every tone in the men's voices. It was clear that the captain was not going to let them have her. The army man was a man with a hard voice, but now his voice dropped and became more conversational.
"How is it charged?" the lieutenant said.
"Number 7 birdshot."
"Can't do much with that. I suppose it's all right." The lieutenant handed it back.
You don't carry a rifle or a handgun?
Well, hell no, said the captain. He slid the shotgun back into the wagon bed.
I might run into some Comanches and they'd take it away from me.
He brought out his tobacco and filled his pipe.
They might shoot me with it, he said.
He struck a match. There was no point in saying anything about the gaudy and corrupt Reconstruction government running Texas, the mindless law against carrying handguns, even up here on the frontier. Johanna listened as the captain's voice developed an edge. He was being insulting to the soldiers. Her eyes brightened.
Yes, very funny, said the lieutenant.
He ran his eyes over everything in the wagon bed, the provisions and blankets, the little iron stove, the portfolio of newspapers, a sack of cornmeal, the sack of dimes and other coins, his shot box with the paper hulls and birdshot, a small keg of flour. He glanced at a flitch of bacon beside the wagon seat on the left side. The lieutenant regarded the flour keg and said,
"What's in that?"
"Flour."
"Very well. I suspect they'll rescind that law here before long. I know people need sidearms to defend themselves."
"Surely not," said the captain. The lieutenant ignored this.
"And you are going where?"
"Weatherford, Dallas, then south to Castroville and San Antonio."
"Very well. A long way. Good day, sir. I wish you a safe trip."
"Sons of bitches," he said.
"You can come out now, Johanna.
You can reappear like the flowers in May. They aren't going to slap you in leg irons and throw you into a cell."
He smoked his pipe as he flicked the reins. The pipe had been carved from kaolin into the shape of a man's head, and in the damp air the smoke hung unmoving so that they traveled on away from it and left it behind them hanging in the air.
"Johanna?"
From behind him he heard,
"Kipton, don't stick a knife in my back. Don't let me hear the dreaded click of a cocked revolver hammer. Let us flounder on through life here as best we might."
"Kipton!"
She sprang lightly over the back of the driver's seat and sat down beside him. She held the revolver in one hand between her knees. She made several signs, of which he only understood one, which was "good," and the other "let loose" or "free," something like that. She smiled for the first time. There was no sign for "thank you." There was no word in Kiowa for "thank you." People should know that one was grateful, because you know you have done something good, something commendable, and there is no need to belabor the point. Kiowa is a tonal language, and it sings up and down the complex verbs, and that by itself should be enough to express gratitude at being saved from the men in blue coats with the big long army revolvers like hog's legs on their thighs, with their coats and pants all exactly the same, which was in itself unnatural. He had faced them down and saved her. She tilted her head to one side to regard him with a bright look on her small round face.
"Yes, let loose," he said. "Free."
He carefully took the .38 from her hand, clicked on the safety, and returned it to the left side of the seat and put the flitch over it again.
She knew how to take the safety off, he thought.
He smiled back at her in a rather stiff grimace. She wrestled with the yards of unfamiliar skirts and settled herself and smiled a small, slight smile at the sepia-toned, dripping world of the Red River Valley. It was more a lift of the powdery blonde eyebrows than a smile. She said something in Kiowa in a happy tone.
"My name is Etipol, the cicada, whose song means there is fruit ripening nearby."
She gestured back toward the big bay saddle horse and tossed her hair back. It was as if she wanted to include Pasha in this newfound happiness.
"Ah, Johanna," he said.
He turned and looked down at her. If the officer had reached for her, he had no doubt she would have cocked the revolver and shot him point blank. He said,
"Your relatives are going to be so happy to get back their sweet, precious lamb."
"Captain," she said brightly, and patted his bony hand.
"Johanna," he said. Spanish Fort was a mile from the river inside a great bend. The Red River was the boundary between Indian territory and that which was not Indian territory. They had passed through a tangled country of short, sharp hills with knobs of stone on top of them that stood like monuments, like curtain walls. As they went on toward Spanish Fort, they passed them by at walking speed and stared at them as if watching distant castles. A storm rolled up out of the northern March sky, out of the plains. They came to the town of Spanish Fort in the late afternoon. It was also known as Red River Station, and with its two names, it was busy. There had been at one time some sort of defensive works here, perhaps Spanish, perhaps not, but they were long gone. The captain held the reins taut and dodged other vehicles. Johanna at first sat in the back, far inside the bulk of the Mexican-made Jorongo. She clutched it tight around her so that she was the shape of a lime kiln in bright red and black. The captain's excursion wagon made sharp noises as the shafts turned on the fifth wheel beneath his feet. They locked wheels briefly with a freight wagon, and it took the driver and the captain and several bystanders to get them backed and free. Pasha sat back on his halter rope but didn't break it. By this time the captain was red mud to the knees. Red mud crusted the laces on his old lace-up boots. The streets were filled with layers of wood smoke as supper was now in preparation in the houses and establishments of the town. He turned his head to look up at second stories and at the people in the second stories, doing what, he could not tell, other than arguing and slamming the windows shut against the wind. Horse soldiers rode by in twos. The wind came running at them from the northwest at full charge and blew off people's hats and tore at clotheslines. Town noises bit at the captain's nerves, and so what must it be like for her? He turned to pat her on the back, thudding gently on the thick red wool. She glanced up at him with fright on her face. There was a great barn on the far edge of town that served as a place to park, but it was full of every imaginable four-wheeled conveyance. Not far away was the U.S. cavalry encampment, so he drove into a tight grove of bur oaks beyond the edge of the town. There he put up the overhead canopy and then one of the side curtains, and the other side curtain he stretched out as an awning over the tailgate. He belled Fancy and then hobbled both her and Pasha and set them loose to graze. He stood for a moment to watch Pasha with his thick, curved neck and large eyes. He was both smooth and calm. He remembered seeing the horse in a lot of 20 to be sold in Dallas. He had instantly turned away, because if the dealer had seen the look on his face, the price would have gone up $100. Finally, the captain went to heave out the flour keg. He took out the box of 38 shells and put it under the seat. "Everything good," he said to Johanna. He beat the flour from his hands. "Here, my dear, do something. Try to get this stove going."
"Yes, Captain. Yes, yes."
She darted under the oaks, still barefoot, to gather firewood. Lightning cracked overhead with a noise like artillery while its blinding neurons of fire ran to every quarter of the sky. Spanish Fort was busy with freight wagons and supply establishments, with longhorn herds milling outside the town waiting to cross and anxious men conferring under canvas as to when the flood would subside, trying to figure out how to get them over the Red before they ate up all the grass on this side of the river and starved. 6. Captain Kidd left her feeding sticks into the toy-like cast-iron stove and walked back into town grasping his hat brim. He found the man who took care of the Masonic Lodge and arranged to rent it that night. Then he walked about town to put up his bills. If he did not have the girl to care for, he would not have to stay at the wagon. He could rent a room with a kerosene lamp and curtains and take a bath, and he could eat in a restaurant. God above knew what she would do if presented with a dinner on a plate. In the light mist, he tacked up each notice with 4 tacks. He had learned long ago that anything less left his advertisements prey to the wind, and they invariably ended up in the hands of people who needed the paper to write grocery lists on, or for other purposes. He came upon a fiddler he knew. Simon Boudelin sat behind the glass window of a storefront that was both a ladies' millinery and a meat market. Simon sat in the window with his chin on his fist and his fiddle under one arm as if he were a display. He was watching the world go by. He was a short man, but he carried himself as if he were 6 feet tall. He had straight, broad, and perfectly square shoulders and slim hips. His thick hair was a halo of unruly brown burrs, and he was freckled as a guinea egg. Simon lifted his fiddle bow by the frog and tapped on the glass. Captain Kidd saw him and went in.
"Simon? Captain? Are you playing tonight? Because I'm reading."
"Where?"
"At the Masonic Lodge."
The captain joined Simon in the window on another chair and laid his tack hammer and the sheaf of advertisements on the floor. He wiped off his old field hat with his sleeve.
"No, it's all right," said Simon. "I have already played. No competition."
He smiled. He had two teeth broken out of his jaw on the left side, but you couldn't see it unless he smiled, and then deep parentheses formed on either side of his mouth. He worked sometimes for the wheelwright, and a wheel had come off the lathe where they were boring out the hub box and struck him in the jaw.
"Why are you here?"
He was not talkative until he had something to say. He was a careful listener and cocked his head like a titmouse, which he did now. Raindrops slid and sparkled on the glass, and beyond it people wavered past with their heads down.
"I'm on my way to Dallas and then on south," said the captain. "Coming from Wichita Falls."
"You got across the Little Wichita, then?"
"Yes, and I think so did Britt Johnson and his crew. They went straight south."
"So you have nothing to do?"
Simon shook his head.
"I just played for the Fort Worth Dancing Schoolmaster. They had the dancing school in the back there."
He pointed with the bow.
"The fellow who was supposed to play guitar for them was tuning his guitar there at the church on the piano, and he got in an octave too high and busted every one of his strings."
Simon bent his head down and laughed.
"Bang, bang, bang, one after the other. You'd think he would have figured it out."
He wiped his hand down his face to stop himself from laughing at the guitar player's misfortunes.
"Well, well, I did it myself once, long ago. And so, they came and got me from the wheelwrights to play for them. You see?"
He plucked a curled shaving from his pants leg.
"Well, then, listen."
Captain Kidd shifted from one foot to another and briefly wondered if Johanna might have already absconded into the woods. He regarded his boots, his pants, mud to the shins. Several women were buying ground meat. A man churned it out of a big spouted grinder in a red sludge. On the other side of the store, a girl and her friend were trying on hats. From the rear of the store came the light voices of yet more girls, and the sound of several young men whose voices were very low and at other times broke and vaulted up the register. They came filing out carrying their dancing slippers. The captain lifted his hat to them.
"Listen," he said.
He groped around in his head for sentences and phrases and words to explain the situation.
I'm listening," said the fiddler.
He lightly tapped the head of the bow on the floor between his feet. Some song was running through his head.
"The thing is, I'm returning a girl who was a Kiowa captive to her people, down south near San Antonio, and she's in the wagon there in that Bur Oak stand behind the livery barn, cooking dinner in my wagon."
Simon looked out the rainy glass at the vehicles passing by, the men and women hurrying along the raw new boardwalk.
"You jest," he said. "That's 400 miles.
"No, I do not."
"How old is she?"
10.
"But, Simon, she is wise in the ways of battle and conflict, it seems to me."
Simon watched a cowboy walk by with his hat slanted against the increasing rain and his boots shining with wet. The fiddler nodded and said,
"They are always at war." "Be that as it may, she has lost all acquaintance with the uses and manners of white people, and I need somebody to keep watch on her while I do my reading. You and your particular friend, Miss Dillon, would do me a great favor if you would sit with her while I read. I'm afraid if I left her alone, she might go bolting off."
Simon nodded slowly, like a walking beam. He thought about it.
"She wants to go back to them," he said.
"She apparently does. I know of a person who was like that, said Simon. They called him Kiowa Dutch. He was blond-haired completely. Nobody knew where he had been captured from or when. He didn't either. I played for a dance there at Belknap when they brought him in. He got away from the army fellows who were returning him, and he is up there yet.
I think I heard about him, said the captain.
He drummed his fingers on his knee.
You know, it is chilling how their minds change so completely. But I have taken on this task, and I have to try.
Simon lifted his fiddle and ran the bow across the strings. His fingers, hard and coarse with joinery work, blunt at the tips, skipped on the strings, and a tune emerged. Virginia Bell.
She bereft us when she left us, sweet Virginia Bell.
Then he stopped and said,
Sorry, I can't help it. So yes, I will go and get Doris.
He sat for a moment, considering where Doris might be. Probably attending a lady named Everettson, who was ill with a fever. A yawn overtook him, and he lifted the back of the fiddle over his mouth the way non-fiddlers would cover a yawn with their hand. He said,
Captain, you have taken on a heavy load here, I'm afraid.
He tapped his fiddle bow on his shoe.
For an old man is what you mean.
Simon stood and then bent to his case, flipped a piece of waxed silk around his instrument, and laid it in the velvet. Click, click, he snapped the catches shut. He straightened.
Yes, for an old man is what I mean exactly.
The captain and Simon and Doris all hurried through the drizzle to the stand of bur oaks. Between their overhead of rust-colored leaves and the canopy and stretched side curtains, the wagon was dry enough. The girl had made them a supper of cornbread and bacon and coffee, and was sitting cross-legged between the long seats like a Hindu yoga with it spread before her. In the lantern light, the gold letters of Curative Waters shone brightly. They ducked under the side curtain awning. Doris pulled off her dripping straw hat and said,
Hello.
Johanna glanced at the captain as if to ask if he, too, saw this female apparition, and then returned her gaze to Doris without saying a word. Doris carried a small bundle. She unwrapped it and held it out to the girl with a bright smile. It was a doll with a china head and painted dark eyes. It wore a dress in a brown and green check and shawl, and its shoes were painted black on china feet. Johanna reached out one dirty hand from under her blanket and took the doll by the foot. She held it around the body for a moment. It was like the Tina sacred figure that was taken from its wrappings only at the sun dance. She looked searchingly into its eyes. Then she propped it against one of the side benches and opened both her hands to it and said something in Kiowa.
"Hmm," said Simon.
He stood under the stretched canvas and tousled his hair to shake off the wet. He had left his fiddle safe in his tiny room over the wagon maker's. He wore an old 1840s infantry coat with a high-band collar. Its surface was a series of patches, some of which overlapped.
"My word! I believe she is addressing it."
The fiddler held out his hands to the heat of the little stove and worked his stiff fingers open and shut to loosen the joints. Doris found the ironstone plates in the cook box. She said,
"She is like an elf. She is like a fairy person from the glamoury. They are not one thing or another."
She laid out the plates wherever she could find room on the tailgate and on tops of boxes. Simon regarded the light of his life with a solemn expression.
"Doris," he said, "your Irish comes out at the strangest times."
"Don't stare at her," said Doris. "That is what she is."
"She thinks it's an idol," said Simon.
The captain bent over the tailgate, searching through his carpet bag, and listened to them.
"Aye, perhaps," said Doris.
She shoveled food onto the plates and laid whatever utensil she could find on each one. The two forks, the camp knife, a serving spoon, and then lifted her head to look at the girl. So alone, twice captured, carried away on the flood of the world. Doris's eyes burned suddenly with tears, and she lifted the back of her hand to her eyes.
"But I think not. The doll is like herself, not real and not real. I make myself understood, I hope. You can put her in any clothing, and she remains as strange as she was before, because she has been through two creations.
Doris laid a plate before the girl. Doris's hair was Irish black with blue lights in it, a rare true black. She was a small woman, and her wrists were ropey with muscle and hard work. She said, "To go through our first creation is a turning of the soul, we hope, toward the light, out of the animal world. God be with us. To go through another tears all the making of the first creation, and sometimes it falls to bits. We fall into pieces. She is asking, where is that rock of my creation?"
The captain took out shaving gear. He went to the far side and hung his mirror on a bolt end and shaved. He said, "Miss Dillon, you know this how."
"On Gortamore," she said. "In the famine, children saw their parents die, and then went to live with the people on the other side. In their minds they went. When they came back, they were unfinished. They are forever falling."
She shook out her wet, pinned-up skirt and watched as Johanna carefully ate pieces of bacon with her hands.
"Well, I don't know what I can do about it."
The captain came back around, put away his gear, and sat on the flour keg. He bent his long, elderly body with a light creaking of the spine and went through his newspapers. He had to make a living. This was intriguing, but first he needed to hear the coins falling into the paint can. Then he could listen to mysteries about unfinished children, trailing their griefs and ragged edges.
"And the newspapers, they say nothing about this at all, or about the poor at all," Doris said. "There are great holes in your newspapers. Nobody sees them. God sees them."
The captain ate his supper and then crossed his knife and fork on his plate and put the plate on the tailgate.
"Yes, I'm sure he does. At any rate, she has to go back to her family. It's only my concern between here and Castroville."
"Who are her people?"
"Germans."
"Ah!"
Doris clapped both hands over her face for a moment and then dropped them in her lap.
"And so now that's three languages the child must know."
She wiped her hands on flour sacking.
"Leave her with us, Captain. We will take her."
Simon stopped eating. He drew in his lower lip and raised both eyebrows in an expression of surprise.
Doris said, "She is like my little sister that died."
"Ahem, Doris, my dear," said Simon. "And so we will be married next month with a child already."
Doris lifted her slim shoulders.
"The priest," she said, "has seen everything."
The captain thought, "The girl is trouble and contention wherever she goes, wherever she lands. No one wants her for herself. A red-headed stepchild destined for the washhouse."
"Miss Dillon, that is generous of you, but I must return her to her relatives, as I said I would do, and for which I took a coin of $50 in gold."
Simon's relief was plain on his face. The girl shrank away into the interior, against the backrest, and hid in the thick harongo. 7. Captain Kidd had changed into his reading clothes in the back of the Masonic Hall. They were a decent black frock coat, knee-length, single-breasted, a matching vest, a white shirt in silk and cotton figured with a lyre design in silk of the same color, that is, a bit yellowed. He had one of the new ascots in black silk and a low-rise rounded silk topper. He stuffed his stained traveling clothes into the carpet bag and then went out and stepped up on the dais. He placed his bull's-eye lantern to the left on a wooden box. It said Kilmeyer Beer, 50 bottles, so it would shine on his newspapers. He greeted the crowd and listened to the clink of dimes and 5-cent pieces, 2-cent pieces, pennies, and sometimes quarters into the paint can, and if it was a quarter, people made their own change. There were a good plenty of people. Mist was still coming down in minute blowing drops from the clouds that raced through the sky over Spanish Fort. He unfolded the London Daily News. He would give them a few paragraphs of hard news and then read of dreamlike places far removed. This was the arrangement of all his readings. It worked. The lantern beam shone sideways onto his face,
casting brilliant lunar cells of light on his cheekbones through the lenses of his reading glasses. He read an article concerning the Franco-Prussian War. It involved delicate Frenchmen, scented with toilet water, being whipped soundly at Wissembourg by huge blonde Germans who were fat and strong on sausages. The outcome was easily predicted. The audience sat rapt, listening. News all the way from France. Nobody knew anything about the Franco-Prussian War, but all were jointly amazed by information that had come across the Atlantic to them, here in North Texas, to their town alongside the flooding Red River. They had no idea how it had got here, through what strange lands it had traveled, who had carried it, why. Captain Kidd read carefully and precisely. His eyeglasses were round and rimmed in gold over his deep eyes. He always laid his small gold hunting watch to one side of the podium to time his reading. He had the appearance of wisdom and age and authority, which was why his readings were popular and the reason the dimes rang into the coffee can. When they read his handbills, men abandoned the saloon, they slipped out of various unnamed establishments, they ran through the rain from their firelit homes, they left the cattle circled and bedded beside the flooding red, to come and hear the news of the distant world. And now he took them away to far places and strange peoples, into mythic forms of thought and the structures of fairy tales. He read from the Philadelphia Inquirer of Dr. Schliemann's search for Windy Troy somewhere in Turkey. He read of the telegraph wires successfully laid from Britain to India, an article in the Calcutta Times forwarded to the London Daily Telegraph, a technological advance that seemed almost otherworldly. As he glanced up, it seemed to the captain that he saw the blonde man again, or at least the glint of ash-blonde hair just at the borders of his light. This went into his mind and then out of his mind as he grappled with the big four sheets of the Boston Daily Journal. To finish, he read of the unfortunate Hansa crushed in the pack ice in its attempt on the North Pole, the survivors rescued by a whaler. This was proving the most popular, as he could see by the small gestures of the audience. They bent forward. They fixed their eyes upon him to hear of undiscovered lands in the kingdoms of ice, fabulous beasts, perils overcome, snow people in furry suits. Simon came in the rear door of the Masonic Lodge just as he was replacing his newspapers into the portfolio.
"Sir, the girl's gone."
Nothing galvanizes people like the news of a missing child. The captain swept everything into his portfolio, his newspapers and eyeglasses, the bull's-eye lantern with its smoldering wick, and the money tin, jammed his silk hat on his head, and ran to the door and straight out into the rain. They had fallen asleep, he and Doris, sitting on the shot box and the flour keg, leaning together against the big rear wheel in front of a good fire. Something made Simon wake up, and she was gone. She had left on foot. The doll was gone, too. It is easier to track a barefoot person than somebody with shoes. The toes dig in with four distinct marks, and the big toe, like a misplaced thumb, broad alongside. The bull's-eye lantern beam picked up her prints on the sloppy red clay road going out of Spanish Fort, east toward the river. The river, which was joyous in its escape from banks and boundaries, which had become a rolling inland sea. They could hear it from half a mile away. The rain increased, lightning came cracking down out of the northwest as the new storm front moved in on them in the night. The lantern lit the million-billion drops that came down in colors of steel and ice. She had followed the ruts in the wagon road that led to the river. The track wound about among the post oak and bur oaks, twisted trees with fright wigs of dry leaves, and soon the track would come to the edge of the flood. The captain walked bent over and rained upon. His joints hurt. He needed to find somebody younger to take her south and deal with this kind of thing, somebody agile and patient and strong. He and Simon the Fiddler soldiered on.
"She's gone, and it's my fault."
Simon slapped himself on the thigh. It made a wet smack.
"Captain, I am so sorry."
He had to shout over the noise of the rain. He gripped his hat brim and ran alongside the captain.
"Never mind,"
the captain shouted back. "Can't be helped." He would as soon have Simon with him as anybody. Despite his short stature, the fiddler was very strong and a hard fighter and a good shot. They ran on into the rain as if into a thicket. They bulled their way through. They tripped over the cut stumps where someone had cleared ground and tangled themselves in the parasitic love vine. They came upon Pasha and Fancy grazing and were snorted at. The captain felt himself growing thinner even as they walked. A man his age should have more weight on him. He should be in a hotel room in Spanish Fort after a good supper and leaning on the sill with tobacco smoke rolling out of his nose, watching the dim lights in the windows and counting his money. This was unfair. They stopped when they saw the glinting water. There at its edge, on a lift of red stone no more than 30 yards ahead, stood Johanna, wet as a dishcloth and her skirts heavy with rain. She clutched the doll to her chest. In the explosive lightning flashes, the captain could see, on the far side of the flood, a party of Indians. They were on the move. They had probably been flooded out of their campsite. The red was still rising. Entire pecan trees rolled and ground like mill wheels in the current. The Indians had stopped to look across, perhaps at the distant lights of Spanish Fort, and Johanna was calling to them in Kiowa, but they could not hear her. It was too far. The river was too loud. "Johanna!" the captain called. "Johanna!" She put down the doll and shouted at the Indians with her hands around her mouth. What could she possibly think would happen? That they would come for her? She was shouting for her mother, for her father and her sisters and brothers, for the life on the plains, traveling wherever the buffalo took them. She was calling for her people who followed water, lived with every contingency, were brave in the face of enemies, who could go without food or water or money or shoes or hats, and did not care that they had neither mattresses nor chairs nor oil lamps. They stood and stared across the water at her like creatures of the Shi, wet and shining in every flash from overhead. They stood among their jack-strawed teepee poles heaped on horses, drenched children gazing at her out of buffalo robes on the travois, the men ahead and at the side with their weapons wrapped in whatever would keep them dry. One of them shouted back over the water. The lightning made them appear in every detail like an intaglio, and then disappear, and then reappear again. Johanna called again. "I have been taken prisoner. Rescue me. Take me back." She would turn her back on the modern world with the telegraph and the railroads and its elaborate political constructions piled layer upon layer. Everything gone. Everything. And she would live in constant movement over the face of the earth, in gratitude to the sun and the grass, often dirty and lousy and wet and cold like those on the other side, but she did not care. One of the warriors on the far side unsheathed a long weapon and lifted it. A lengthy barrel shone blue-white in a lightning flash. He aimed it and fired, a muzzle flash as long as a chimney brush, and then the heavy bullet struck the stone near them and sent pieces of red sandstone flying. The report came to them as a dull chunk sound. They had not heard her. They didn't know who she was. A warning shot. Stay away. The fiddler and the captain fell flat, hands stretched in the tall brown grasses. "That was a sharps!" shouted the fiddler. The girl still called out. She had not moved. Then she bent to place the doll to sit against the rock, facing Indian territory.
50 caliber, said the captain. "If he fired once, he'll fire again."
He jumped up and grabbed the 10-year-old girl by the back of her dress and swung her around and ran. He shifted his grasp to one of her arms, and the fiddler got the other arm, and so they dragged her back to her fate. To the wagon, to the white man's necessary world, which did not seem to want her either. Another giant 520-grain bullet tore through the air overhead. Even above the noise of the rain, they heard the nyow-wow-wow sound, and it hit a bur oak and tore off a limb big as a drain pipe. At the curative waters wagon, the captain sat awake late in the rainy dark and counted his money and thought about the long series of roads to San Antonio and Castroville. The girl was asleep. He slowly changed his clothes. He hurt in all his joints. He reflected on how she had not cried once. His pipe and the tot of rum Doris and Simon had left for him were of some comfort. He needed it. He stewed silently at the imposition of it all. He must have been out of his mind. Senile dementia. But he had promised. "I'll do it," he thought. "I will get her back to her relatives if I never cock another gun." He read through the Boston paper, staring mindlessly at the advertisements for cures and false hair. They continued on to the south. He had forgotten to find a blacksmith for the cracked tire rim, but the wheels had swollen in the wet and perhaps had seized it tight to the fellows. The trace chains jingled, the horse's hooves kicked up little gouts of mud, the forested hilly landscape slowly moved backward on either side. It was a mild day with white steam rising from the damp hollows. He would have to get the tire fixed in Dallas, and his money was short. After he had paid the Masonic Hall and bought more supplies and grain for the horses, there was not much left. Since they had left the town, she now sat up beside him and sang to herself, one hand dancing in the air. With the resilience of a 10-year-old, she had accepted that she could not cross the Red and rejoin her people, and so she sang and made dancing gestures. "Well then, Johanna," he said. He had calmed himself. It was time to be patient. "Auntie, Uncle, you will soon see them." She stared straight ahead with a blank look that meant a dredging of the mind, a searching through old indexes. He tried German. "Tante Anna," he said. "Onkel Wilhelm." She turned to him. "Ja," she said. There was surprise in her voice. Then she seemed to struggle with a tangled thing inside her head, something knotted that would not unknot. She opened both stained hands on her lap and stared at the palms. She shut her fingers. She wasn't really seeing anything. Her face was no longer a child's face, but one that had gone through something beyond description or comprehension, and so was suspended for a moment in wordlessness. Her hands opened and shut, opened and shut. And then she spoke. "Mama, Papa." She lifted her head to him. "Tot," she said. They rolled through a bur oak forest with the steady click of the brake in the iron tire counting out its revolutions. Fancy's harness jingled. Crooked zigzag limbs sifted through the air. Beneath them the crisp shells of acorns made crushed sounds. The captain looked down at her, into her guileless eyes and the rediscovered pain in them. Sudden, terrible memories. He bit the left side of his lower lip and was sorry he had brought it up. He tucked the blanket more tightly around her neck and smiled at her. He said, "Never mind, my dear. Let's try an English lesson." She nodded gravely with one hand opening and shutting on a sleeve flounce. "Hand," he said. He held up his hand. "Hunt," she said. "Horse." He pointed to Fancy jogging along ahead of them. "Horse." The captain knew nothing of the Kiowa language, but he knew it had no R. "Very good," he said in a cheerful tone.
"Felly good."
But now her voice was low and discouraged. She had left the Tina to keep watch across the Red River for her. That was taken care of. Now she had to begin a new, long, hard road to somewhere else. "Felly good." They crossed Clear Creek and then Denton Creek, and 2 days later they came finally into the small town of Dallas about 4 o'clock of a chilly afternoon. The girl was even more subdued and frightened than in Spanish Fort, stunned by the noise and the wagons. There were several two-story buildings of brick and stone. She jumped back into the rear and pressed against the backrest of the wagon seat, between the flour keg and his carpet bag. They came into town on the North Road, where it led past several blacksmith shops with their great shed-roof caverns and lit with scarlet light, full of men and horses, tobacco smoke, and the noise of metal being forced to hold the things of this world together, bolt by bolt. Johanna glanced into them with deep apprehension. The captain was happy to see them. He would bring the wagon in tomorrow. First, of course, he would have to ask the price of a new tire rim and the labor. On into town, down Trinity Street, full of white men wearing their tight-fitting clothing and women in dresses that were architectural constructions of cloth and whalebone. Johanna gazed with some interest at two black women carrying shopping baskets with the heads of alarmed hens sticking out. Finally, the captain came into Gannett's livery stable yard, and there stepped down. The stableman took hold of Fancy's driving bridle and cried, "Whoa there!" as if the weary little roan were about to charge through the back end of the fairway. "Hang on to her there," said the captain. "She's about to go completely wild on you." Fancy hung her head and rolled her tongue under the straight bar of the driving bit, and then yawned. "Never know," the man said. "Unpredictable. New horse. Never saw it before." He hiccuped. "Yes," said the captain. "You must only see new horses 3 or 4 times a day." The man unhitched the little roan and took the harness from her back. The captain could smell alcohol on the man's breath. Mrs. Gannett came out of the feed storage room with 3 empty flowered feed sacks in her hands. Her bonnet sat on the back of her head, and the strings hung down over her shoulders. Still very trim, the captain thought. Girlish waist. "Captain Kidd," she cried. She smiled and came to stand with one hand on the curative Waters wagon's side to see the girl staring out of the red wool with eyes like a carp. She turned to the captain with an interrogative look. As he explained, he stood at the high back wheel with one arm on it, taller than Mrs. Gannett by a head. Even as he told his story, he wondered that she ran the livery stable by herself. He was worn and stained with Red River sludge, and he had to go about buying newspapers in what he stood up in. No help for it.
"San Antonio," said Mrs. Gannett. "God above! That is very far, Captain, and you'll be alone on the roads. There's news of more raids all through the country."
She turned to the stableman to see what he was doing. The captain knew that raids were how she had become a widow. A year ago they had found Mr. Gannett in several pieces along the Weatherford Road, and none of them had any clothes on them. She said,
"Wait for a convoy, will you not?"
"Yes, yes," he said. "We'll see. It will be all right."
He saw her dubious expression.
"I'm armed," he said, "a sidearm and a shotgun. And now I have to go find the latest newspapers and a hotel. May I leave her with you for a few hours? I don't think she'll run away and go flitting about Dallas. In Spanish Fort there was some place to go, the river. Here she's deep inside enemy territory, so to speak."
He ran his blue-veined hand over a 2-day growth of silver grizzle. "I'm a mess, Mrs. Gannett." She laughed and said for the captain to go about his business. She could look after the girl. If he would care to change in the feed room, she would send out his traveling clothes to Mrs. Carnahan, and also she would ask Mrs. Carnahan if she had a second-hand dress to fit the girl, and perhaps other necessary garments. The girl needed a change of clothing. He reached for his portfolio and looked down at her. Widowed, no more than 45, painfully young. She had eyes of a leaf-colored hazel and a good smile.
"I'm very grateful," the captain said.
He lifted his hat to her, replaced it.
"I will settle up when we leave tomorrow."
He turned to Johanna and was surprised when her small hand appeared out of the horongo and reached for his. She was very frightened and perhaps thought she was to be handed over to yet another stranger. He smiled and put his hand on her forehead, briefly, in lieu of patting her cheek, which was hidden behind the red wool.
"It's all right," he said. "It's all right."
He took out his hunting watch. Then he put it back. Johanna had no idea of time. It was pointless to tell her he would be back in an hour. so he just said, "Sit. Stay." 8. The captain changed, left his traveling clothes with Mrs. Gannett, and went back out onto the street. He took his portfolio of newspapers under his arm, and then engaged two rooms in a hotel on